Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 228, Positive Psychology Coaching with Dr. John Schinnerer.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I don't know how much your listeners know about positive psychology in general, but basically it's not a self-help movement. It's not a fad. It is a new branch of science based on a mountain of research into how and when people function at their very best. And I think at last count, maybe a year or two ago, there were about 50,000 peer-reviewed studies that are looking at what make people function optimally. And to me, that's what really separates it from, you know, Tony Robbins or Marianne Williamson or some The Secret. You know, it's not those things. It's grounded in science, and it's a change after roughly 100 years in the medical profession from what is wrong with us to what is right with us.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. John Schinnerer, who uses positive psychology as the underlying framework in his personal coaching practice. John Schinnerer, PhD, is in private practice helping individuals learn happiness by mitigating destructive emotions and fostering constructive emotions. Using positive psychology, he helps clients achieve happy, thriving, meaningful lives. He graduated summa cum laude from the University of California at Berkeley with a PhD in educational psychology. Dr. Schinnerer has been an executive and psychologist for over 12 years. He's president and founder of Guide to Self, a company that coaches clients to their potential using the latest in positive psychology, emotional management, mindfulness, and attentional control. He's hosted over 200 episodes of Guide to Self Radio, a primetime radio show on positive psychology in the San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. Schinnerer's areas of expertise range from positive psychology to emotional awareness to moral development to sports psychology. He wrote the award-winning Guide to Self, The Beginner's Guide to Managing Emotion and Thought, which is available at Amazon.com and other online booksellers. And he's currently collaborating with the University of New Zealand in a longitudinal positive psychology study called the International Well-Being Study. You can send Dr. Schinnerer email via john@guidetoself.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John Schinnerer, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here, David.
Well, as you know, I discovered your blog as I was searching for resources to help me formulate a proposal that I was putting together for a market research conference in Prague this coming May. You know, you may recall, I was hoping to show how developments in positive psychology might inform marketing and market research, and your blog was the one place where I found someone whose thinking seemed to be running along some similar lines. And since then, you and I have had several phone conversations, and I thought you'd make a great guest for this podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here. This should be a fun and interesting conversation.
Yes. Well, tell us how you found your way into psychology and then eventually into positive psychology and coaching.
Wow, into psychology. Let's see, I had some interesting experiences when I was younger. In high school, for instance, I was student body president, captain of three varsity teams, a good overachieving student, a little bit perfectionistic, ran into a teacher in high school that was a little bit off balance. And she became actually my student government advisor, and that's a whole other story. But basically, let's say it was very hard to hold on to my version of reality during that year because she wanted to know everything about me, every personal detail. She wanted to be with me, wanted to talk to me on the phone at night. and was very intrusive in terms of my boundaries. And at the time, I didn't even know what boundaries were.
Right.
I was just trying to survive and get through high school and get to college. And the, you know, that's a whole hour conversation there. But basically, the biggest, she had a number of hooks in me. Primarily the fact that she had power over my grades, the awards I would get at the end of the year. And the biggest one was the threat that she would take her own life if I ever ended the relationship, which did not involve any sort of sexual activity. It was just sort of this unusual, strange, off-balance relationship. So that was one of my first glimpses into psychology and how powerful relationships can be on other people, myself included. It was also a glimpse into how powerful emotions were, because I would get sick and stressed very frequently that year because I was under just a tremendous amount of pressure. And as I said before, my version or my perception of reality was tenuous at times because there was a lot of things going on at that time that were difficult. I met my wife at that point in time.
When you were in high school? Are we still in high school?
Yes, so this was senior year in high school.
Okay.
And so we've been together for a long time now. I think we've been married 18 years and together 25.
Yeah, wow.
And then I went to college and majored in philosophy, went away to study at University of Edinburgh for a while, which was a great experience. It really kind of pushed the envelope for me in terms of my comfort level, my anxiety. And when I came back, my friends had set me up in two-bedroom with a friend of mine, an acquaintance of mine, who came back after the Christmas break, sort of the first time seeing him in 6 or 8 months. And I said, he said to me, how was your Christmas break? And I said, it was great. How was yours? And he said, not so good. My dad killed himself over the break. And, you know, it turns out his dad had taken a gun to his mouth in the basement of the house when he and his mom were upstairs, didn't leave a note. So a very destructive, difficult situation for him to deal with. And I found myself spending the semester in college sort of trying to walk that path with him and make sense of, you know, dreams that he was having where he would talk to his dad. You know, you could just tell his mind was trying to make sense of this horrible tragedy that befell him.
Of course.
And so that was one as well. And several experiences like that just sort of led me into psychology and a fascination with the human mind, with the power that thinking has over us, and with the sort of additional power that emotion has over us. Because when I went to UC Berkeley for my PhD, there was a lot of emphasis on cognitive psychology, which is basically how we think, as you know.
Yes.
There wasn't much mention made of emotion because it was squishy. It was hard to measure. It was unscientific at the time. And so I just kind of put my head down and put my nose to the grindstone and thought, okay, I'm going to get through this. Get the PhD because I'm going to need that and the UC Berkeley name behind me to get more at what really interests me, which is sort of the power of emotion and how do we deal with that? Because emotion was something that I had struggled with throughout my life.
You know, you're going to, as I hear the story, you're going to have to write your memoir at some point.
Yeah. It's an interesting story. It's fun. It's been challenging.
Well, that relationship with that teacher in high school,
that
sounds so bizarre. There is a whole story there, I'm sure.
And I think that was one of the driving forces. Like, okay, what made this individual person up to act and behave in this manner where she did things like tell me that she loved me more than her own 5 children?
Oh, my goodness.
Like, that's just not something you want to lay on a 17-year-old student in
my mind.
But the other experience that I had was when I came out of, or when I had finished part of my education at Cal, I was an intern as a school psychologist in some pretty heavy school districts, Oakland, Alameda, Berkeley, and I ended up in Fremont. And I enjoyed the job where the best part of the job was talking to the students, whether it was elementary school or middle school or high school. The best part was talking to them. I guess you could call it counseling. What I found, however, was that you know, all these kids had very heavy stories. So they had stories filled with sadness, anger, fear, disappointment, and hurt. And we know now, or we're beginning to understand, that emotions are contagious. So for counselors, therapists, psychologists, you know, you tend to hear these stories, especially when you're a newbie, when you're a rookie, and you take in the emotions of other people. And no one ever teaches you ways to get those, let's call them negative, destructive emotions out. So I found myself holding on to a lot of their anger, fear, and sadness, and it wound up with me becoming depressed. My back went out, and I was laying on the floor of my office thinking, okay, this is absurd. How can I, as a psychologist, ask other people to manage their emotions and get their lives together when I can't myself? And so at that point, it was about 1997, I started looking into what are the best scientifically proven techniques to manage negative emotions, mainly fear, anger, sadness, and all their variations. And then later on, I came across positive psychology, which put a big emphasis on how do you cultivate more positive emotions and why do you want to do that? And so to me, that was sort of a perfect fit. So between cognitive behavioral therapy, which focuses more on, well, somewhat more on thinking, together with ways to manage negative emotions and ways and the whys of how you want to create and be aware of more positive emotions, that was enough to me to kind of run out into the field and say, okay, I think I've got a pretty good idea of what's going on here and how I can be of more help to people.
Yes, and you've written a book, which I've been enjoying reading very much, and people can get it at Amazon.com, probably among other places. It's called Guide to Self. And I thought maybe I would ask you some questions that are kind of based on that reading.
Absolutely.
Well, in there you talk about six areas necessary for a successful and happy life, and you use the acronym INSPIRE. Can you give us an overview of those six areas, you know, and what the letters INSPIRE stand for?
Sure. And this was a result of a businessman approached me in 2004 and asked me if I wanted to create sort of an executive life coaching company. And I said, sure, I'd love to. Let me look at the research that's out there and see what we're coaching towards. I'd like to have a framework if we're going to be coaching. I want to know where we're headed. And so I read, I don't know, 800, 1,000 studies, and then pieced together this framework from those. And so the acronym is INSPIRE, and the IN stands for inward looking, because depending on different accounts, somewhere between 40 to 80% of our happiness, our contentment, is inside our mind, in between our ears.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, you know, it depends who you talk to, but let's take the conservative approach and say 40% of our happiness is within our control. Roughly 50% of it, at latest estimate, is genetic. So that's sort of what you're born with. You're born with this happiness set point. 10% of your happiness is due to situation or the environment around you. So it's based on how much money you make, what car you drive, who you hang out with, who you're married to, who your significant other is, that sort of thing. And then 40% is due to sort of what you're aware of, what you attend to, how you think, and how well you manage your feelings. And those are all things that we can learn to do better. So 40% of your happiness can actually be boosted or increased. You can actually learn how to be happier. The S in INSPIRE is for spiritual, and I differentiate spirituality from religion, which, again, is its own topic, but the distinction in my mind is religion is man or woman standing between the individual and the higher power.
Yes.
It's organized religion. Spirituality is someone's direct relationship with a higher power. And I've spoken to a lot of people on this subject, and I don't, you know, it's not my job to tell people who or what to believe in. I consider myself a psychologist, not a clergy or a pastor. And so I tend to be open-minded about spirituality. I consider myself an open-minded Christian with a little Buddhism thrown in. However, the research has shown that it's important to have a belief in a forgiving, loving, kind, higher power. That a belief in sort of the Old Testament God or some of the more punitive, vengeful, angry gods is not as helpful in our overall well-being.
Yes. Let me just put in a footnote here.
Sure.
Because, first of all, I really like your definition of spiritual. I've interviewed many people on this topic, and I always press people, well, how do you define that? And you've given a very succinct definition. And the other thing was your mention of kind of a fusion of Christianity with a little bit of Buddhism thrown in.
Yes.
There's an article in my morning paper that I was reading this morning talking about how complex American religious views are. It turns out that you're in the majority, that something, I don't remember all the percentages, but some very large percentage of people who consider themselves Christian also believe in topics such as reincarnation or astrology. And so the point of the article, it's a study done by the Pew Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do lots of studies. And evidently, just as a society, we are all holding a rather complex set of beliefs. So I just wanted to share that. But let's keep moving. You've got inward-looking,
sure.
Spiritual.
So the I in inspire, the middle I, is for intellectual, which is not the best label I could come up with, but it fits in the acronym. So the I for intellectual is more about how you think about the world. So part of that is identifying the gremlins, the negative thoughts that you have, and the different types of gremlins so that you can challenge them. And then the other part of it is finding ways to think more realistically optimistic based on Martin Seligman's work.
Okay. And you skipped P, which was
physical.
Oh,
I'm sorry. P is for physical. Again, part of my framework is that your body is a gift to you, and you have to take care of it. You've got to respect it. So you've got to stay in shape. Ideally, you would work out 20 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and you want to keep the weight off. It's pretty simple. But, you know, again, if you go to some of Dan Millman's work, which is not based on research, but which I admire, you're looking to keep your flexibility up as you get older, keep your strength up as you get older, and keep your cardiovascular up as you get older, in order to maintain the best physical body you can as you age.
Makes sense to me.
So that's,
I'm trying.
Yeah, well, you know, and we do the best we can too.
Yeah.
And part of it's self-compassion. So you want to be compassionate with yourself when things like injuries come up or illness and you can't work out. And then, you know, you start to work yourself back slowly into shape when you have the opportunity.
It's true, you know, that we can get, at least it's been my experience, that I can get so fanatical about being physical that I end up hurting myself. And then, you know, it takes months to recover from having gotten all macho about it.
Yeah, speaking of macho, I agreed to play indoor soccer here in January with a team of men that are, you know, 40-something, and we're going to be playing in a league with 21 and up, and I'm a little worried about the risk of injury, so I'll let you know how that goes.
Yeah, good luck with that.
But I'm excited about it, too.
Yeah.
Okay, so the P is physical, the I is intellectual, the R is relational, and I can't tell you how much bigger this has become in my mind over the past 3 years. You know, obviously it's important to surround yourself with the right people, with people that are supportive, non-judgmental, more positive than negative. The problem is those people are hard to find. They might be, you know, 15 to 20% of the population. So then you've got to find ways to draw appropriate boundaries. Going back to my original story with the high school teacher,
mm-hmm.
You know, how do you assert yourself and say, no, this isn't appropriate. I'm not comfortable with this. I need to leave this situation or change the situation to improve it. The other thing that's coming up is that our emotions, as I mentioned before, are contagious. And we're seeing more and more studies come out that are showing the power of emotions such as loneliness, anger, and happiness, and how they're socially contagious and can pass through a social network and not only influence the people directly around you, but people that are one degree removed from you. So, for instance, if I'm angry and I get angry at one of my children in the morning and they go to school with that anger, mm-hmm. they might pass that anger on to one of their classmates. The classmate in turn might pass that anger on to someone else, and it spreads.
Wow. So both positive and negative emotions are contagious, right?
Exactly. So again, all the more reason to, number one, be aware of your own emotions and cultivate more positive emotions so that you can spread them and share them. And also to be aware of how others are treating you and what emotions they're bringing to you.
I liked, you know, talking about emotions. You have a discussion of emotions in your book, and you talk about the role of positive and negative emotions that they play in our lives and kind of how and why they're there. Maybe that's something that you can comment on, the sort of balance of positive and negative emotions.
Sure. So the last letter in INSPIRE is E for emotional. So let's head to emotions.
Okay. Yeah.
So the first many years of my life, I spent a lot of time in what I would say are negative or destructive emotions. So most of it was sadness. Some of it was fear or anxiety. There was some anger and irritability in there. And, you know, like most people, I could mask those when I was at school or at work. However, when I come home, that's usually the place where most people just go bleh, and all that sort of negative emotional energy comes out, which makes home life a rather not so pleasant place to be. And one of the things we found in the past 5 to 7 years is that, well, we've known that negative emotions for a long time narrow our attention. They're action scripts that have been there for millions of years that many of which are pre-thought. So in other words, if the bear comes out of the woods, you see the bear, you run away, then you go, oh my gosh, I was afraid. Anger exists to help us to remove obstacles from our path between us and our goals. It helps us to fight social injustice. Sadness helps to keep us close to home when we've suffered a loss so we can rebuild our resources. It helps us to be near loved ones at a time when we need that. So in general, negative emotions help us to focus our attention to a point. And we're not trying to eliminate any negative emotions. We're just trying to have more of a conscious choice in how we act as a result of a given emotion. So many of us just feel anger and we act in an angry manner. And we don't realize that there's a difference, a separation between the feeling anger and how you might act as a result of that anger. Now, on the flip side, positive emotions, and this just came out with Barbara Fredrickson, who's one of the greater minds that that I know of in positive psychology. She came up with a broaden and build theory of positive emotions, which basically says that positive emotions open you up. They open you up to new possibilities of thinking. So they broaden your thought processes or the thought processes available to you. So if you want to innovate, if you want to create, if you want to write, if you want to think outside the box, you want to be in a positive emotional state. And that's not necessarily something high in intensity, like a spastic joy or a manic state. It might be something relatively mellow in intensity, like contentment or relaxation or peacefulness. It could be something like awe or surprise. The build part of her theory is that positive emotions build lasting internal resources, which means that there seems to be some sort of metaphorical reservoir inside of us, one for negative emotions, one for positive emotions. So the more that you can cultivate positive emotions, the more you fill up your internal bucket of positive emotions that you can use down the road to share with other people, people that need a little bit of love, a little bit of guidance, support, generosity. And then the other finding that she made, which is one of the most remarkable to me, is the fact that positive emotions act as a hidden reset button for the lingering physiological effects of negative emotions. So we know, for instance, that chronic stress does things to the body like increase heartbeat, increase cortisol rate. Cortisol is the stress hormone. Yes. And elevates blood pressure. So what we've found is that if you're stressed out, if you're angry, if you're fearful or sad, when you go into a positive emotional feeling, it undoes those physiological effects. It brings down the cortisol rate. It brings down your heart rate. It brings down your blood pressure. And to me, that's amazing because so much of our time is spent in that chronic state of stress. And we don't even realize it much of the time. But now there's a way to undo those effects. And it's as simple as putting yourself into a positive emotional space.
Which we can choose to do, right?
Right. And the best example I can give you of that, and one that seems to resonate with a lot of people, is imagine there's a teenage daughter, a teenage girl, and she is arguing with her parents. And they are just locked into a drop dead, knocked down argument. Everyone's hot. Everyone's angry. Everyone's frustrated. All of a sudden, the phone rings. The little brother goes up to pick it up and says, "Sister, it's your boyfriend." And the young girl walks over to the phone and says, "Oh, hi, Bobby. How are you? I was just thinking about you." And all of a sudden, like a light switch, her emotional state is changed from fury, rage, to contentment or being glad to have this call. And it's just, it's instant. And you do have a choice over it. We just tend to give up that choice out of habit, I think, and out of mindlessness.
Right. That's where mindfulness comes in, right? Is being aware of choice.
Mm-hmm.
I loved your alligator metaphor and how you talked, how you say it. It comes from Spanish. Can you run that by us?
Sure. The alligator metaphor I liked, it was John Haidt came up from University of Virginia, came up with the rider on an elephant metaphor, where the mind, one of the ways to divide the mind is two parts. You've got the rational thinking part and the emotional feeling part. And they're based on brain structures, which I don't think we need to go into here. But the idea is that the person riding the elephant is the thinker, and the elephant is the feeling part of the mind. And the goal is to get them to work together in concert. You know, personally, I like the alligator wrestler with the alligator because I think it's more of a battle than a person just sitting atop an elephant. And to me, the alligator as the emotional mind sort of is always laying in wait just below the surface of the water, just as our emotional mind is always laying in wait. It's always scanning the horizon for signs of danger. And both the alligator, the emotional mind, and emotions can pounce on you suddenly without warning whenever what they think the prey is comes along.
And another thing that you point out, yep, is that in Spanish, alligator, I guess, is el ligator.
Yes, ligato.
Which means the lizard.
Translates to the lizard, and it's the lizard brain or the limbic system, which is responsible for most of our emotions.
Yeah, so I just thought, that's really wonderful. And by the way, I'd want my listeners and you to know that I interviewed John Haidt. Is that how you say
yes.
it? Haidt?
Yes.
And I loved his book as well.
Yes, fantastic. Yeah. The Happiness Hypothesis.
Yes, I have it on my bookshelf, and we'll be referring to it along with yours.
And the other thing I like about the alligator metaphor is that, you know, alligators get in those death rolls.
Yes.
Where they lock their jaws onto a prey, and they will roll back and forth in this death roll where they will try and kill their prey. And that, to me, has the same sort of feeling as an intense negative emotion like anger or rage or fury, where you just get locked in and over-focused on what's wrong, what you're angry about, and you cannot let it go. At least you think you cannot let it go.
Yeah. So what's your advice for mastering negative emotions and fostering positive emotions?
Boy, there's all sorts of tools that I have now, but typically, for instance, when I see a client in the first session, I will walk them through sort of what emotions are. I will share with them some of what's in the book in terms of the physiological symptoms of anger, sadness, fear. So here's what you want to look out for. In anger, for instance, your blood rushes to your feet and to your hands. And typically, your hands will be in fists because your body is preparing you to attack. Your heart rate goes up. Your breathing becomes shallow. You overfocus on what's making you angry. And so there's cues that you can learn to increase your awareness so that you can become aware of the emotional state that you're in, ideally within a third of a second. Because we know from research studies that you can actually interrupt that anger cycle if you can get aware of it within about 0.33 seconds.
That's pretty fast. Yeah,
it is. But as you become aware of it, it becomes second nature. It becomes automatic. So at first you've got to think about it and it's tough. After a while, it becomes like driving a car where it's just automatic and you say, okay, my heart rate's increasing. I'm getting angry. I need to take a time out. I need to breathe deeply. I need to leave the situation. I need to tell so-and-so that I'd like to talk later because I'm getting heated. There's any number of things you can do. And also the more you become aware of it and the more you do certain exercises that I would put in the positive psychology umbrella that reduce the overall amount of anger that you've been sitting on for many, many years. Because like most of us, no one has taught us how to get rid of, how to dump that negative bucket of emotions over.
What would one of those exercises be?
Well, to me, the biggest one, the greatest one for getting rid of anger is the practice of forgiveness.
Okay.
And on the face of it, it doesn't sound like much. However, when I was doing the radio show, I interviewed Fred Luskin from Stanford.
Yes, I've interviewed him as well.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Yeah. So he's director of the Stanford Forgiveness Project and has a book out called Forgive for Good. And he's basically broken down forgiveness into a series of steps and explained why you want to do it, what it is not, and then encourages you to engage in a daily practice of forgiveness. And basically, when you get right down to it, it's quite simple. It's the idea that you want to go through a list of people that you believe have wronged you and forgive them. And there's more to it than that, but basically it's just running through a list of people at the end of the day and saying, I forgive my mom for standing me up at the bus station today. I forgive my dad for not being around enough when I was a small child. And you go through this list of what you're angry about, and it takes maybe, might take 10 minutes in the beginning. And you forgive what's gone on in the past. And after a while, your list of people and things that you're forgiving gets shorter and shorter and shorter because the things that used to bother you stop bothering you. You're not as angry about them, or you're not angry about them at all anymore. And what I've found is that the process becomes shorter and shorter and shorter until all the things in the past that I can remember anyway have been forgiven. And so they hold no power or less power over me. And then I'm just forgiving things that happened that day. And I think I may have told you I have 4 young children, and so I've got lots of opportunities to practice forgiveness on a daily basis.
Right. Well, we have a number of things in common. I have 4 kids. I was student body president of my high school. Wow. I played varsity sports. I think there are other things that I recognize as we've been going along that we have in common. We're both psychologists. We're both interested in positive psychology. So what about the fostering of positive emotions? Do you have some advice about how people might tackle that?
Yeah, there's lots of things, actually. And I don't know how much your listeners know about positive psychology in general, but basically it's not a self-help movement. It's not a fad. It is a new branch of science based on a mountain of research into how and when people function at their very best. And I think at last count, maybe a year or two ago, there were about 50,000 peer-reviewed studies that are looking at what make people function optimally. And to me, that's what really separates it from, Tony Robbins or Marianne Williamson or The Secret. It's not those things. It's grounded in science, and it's a change after roughly 100 years in the medical profession from what is wrong with us to what is right with us. It's looking at what do we do well, what are our strengths, how do we cultivate more positive emotion. So there's several different, it's kind of a complex question that you ask. some of the short answers are things like practice mindfulness, which is basically the practice of breathing deeply, focusing on your breath, and being aware of your thoughts and feelings as they pass through your head. And here's the big part, the simple but not easy part, is learn to observe your thoughts and feelings without judging them as good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone goes, oh yeah, that's kind of tough. And it does take some practice, but it has huge benefits. There's 25 to 30 years of research on mindfulness alone in terms of improving performance at work, improving performance at school, health benefits. And Jon Kabat-Zinn is the one that I follow most closely in that area. Other things would be exercises in gratitude, for instance. So what are you grateful for? There's one of the most famous positive psychology exercises is one done by Seligman that took, I think it was 50 severely depressed people, people that couldn't get out of bed and function, and said, we want you to do one thing each day for 2 weeks. And that one thing was write down three things that went well today and why they went well. And after 2 weeks, they found that the vast majority of these 50 people had severely less symptoms of depression than when they began the study. So it was as powerful as an antidepressant and acted more quickly.
That's a great study. I thought I knew Seligman's work, and I knew about the gratitude exercise, but I didn't know about that particular testing of it with depressed people.
Yeah. And so there's other things, too. I mean, just like altruism, helping out other people. And I can give you an example. And it's funny, altruism can be harder than you think sometimes. You think, well, I'm just going to volunteer somewhere and help out, and that will do it. And that will. That's a great way to go. I was in a situation recently where my mom had hip surgery and had some complications from it. And, you know, I would go over there and visit her, and I was... My parents are very high-achieving, proud people, and I kept calling my dad and saying, you know, can I come over there and help you out and spend some time with mom while you're at work or whatever, and I kept getting sort of brushed off, and I think pride was getting in the way, and finally I just said, okay, I'm just going to go over there without asking. And so I went over, I showed up in my dad's office, I said, I need a house key, I'm going to go over and hang out with mom while you're here at work. Went over, hung out with my mom for 3 or 4 hours, and it went very well. She was very appreciative. My point is that sometimes you have to force the hand, I guess.
Hmm. You know, that sort of feeds into a question that I wanted to ask you, and something that you touched on, I think, in your book. Before you discovered these tools, your life in some ways was not satisfying to you and was in a bit of disarray. So yes. I wanted to have you take us through that and tell us how these tools have helped you in your own personal life.
Okay, great question. The reason that I wrote the book initially was for my own benefit. I have 4 children, as I mentioned. My wife had always had a dream of having 4. I was more of a 2-person kind of guy.
Right.
And, you know, even my mom to this day will say, well, you know, you're not cut out for 4 kids. And it's like, well, okay, maybe that's the way I was, but I can change. I mean, that's what we know. We know that the brain is plastic and changes throughout the lifespan, and it changes in a matter of hours and minutes, not months and years. And so that's also something I throw into presentations, that, you know, the brain that you come into this presentation with is not the brain you will leave this presentation with. Your brain will change in that hour-long span.
Uh-huh.
So I had to find a way to sort of remain centered, remain calm, remain emotionally level or balanced amidst the chaos that is my family. I've got 2 boys, 2 girls, ranging from age 3 to 14. It's a very busy, very active household. And so, you know, first I went into, okay, how do I manage the negative emotions, which is what I typically do with clients, because that's normally where they're coming in. Is they're coming in with a point of pain, usually fear, anger, sadness related. And then I move from there to how do I cultivate more positive emotions and add that to it? So am I thinking properly to get the best out of my life, as well as, and, you know, part of it to me is things like getting exercise, and that goes back to the physical part of the INSPIRE acronym. Part of it is things like, what are your top five values? What are you willing to live for and die for? So just having the clarity there to help with decision-making in the moment when you start to get hot under the collar. And then say, wait, okay, family is one of my top values. Do I really want to be screaming at my child? No, that's not really consistent with my top value of family.
Mm-hmm.
Having a sense of humor is key. The other one that's big is learning how to savor and appreciate the littlest things in your day-to-day life. And it could be as small as a smile or a hug from my three-year-old. It could be as small as one of my sons asking me to go out back and kick a ball around, because they're not going to want to do that for the rest of their life. You know, somewhere along the way, they're going to get older and mm-hmm. want to hang out with their friends more than hang out with me.
Definitely.
It might be something as simple as taking a moment to appreciate the egret that flies around the creek next door to us. Just looking at the birds and saying, wow, that's something. I feel very blessed just to be in an area where there are trees and there are birds. So there's a number of things to it. Mindfulness has been a big part of it. Learning to ask the right questions or not ask the wrong questions is a big part of it.
You know, in the book you talk about optimism versus pessimism. How about in your own balance? Did you start out as pessimistic and have been moving towards optimism, or are
Absolutely.
You one of those people who is sort of born optimistic?
No, my wife was blessed that way. She was fortunate to be more optimistic innately. And I was, you know, I come from a high-achieving German family that very much focused on grades and achieving, and you are what you do, not what you are. So it was more about doing than being. And part of that was a big emphasis on critical thinking and sort of tearing things and people down, or at least judging them harshly.
Mm.
And so I had to learn how to undo that learning that, you know, was maybe 30 years of learning, and learn how to be more appreciative, more realistically optimistic, not foolishly optimistic, but ways to look for the best in the situation and to encourage and cultivate that rather than look for and find the worst. Because when I was younger, I was very good at, I guess I was born with a knack for finding people's soft spots. I could read people very well. I was intuitive. I picked up people's emotions. And so in middle school, I learned that I could insult people and get at their soft spots quickly and easily. And it didn't take me very long before I realized that I didn't like people doing that to me. So maybe I shouldn't be doing that to other people.
Good insight. glad you had that insight. You know, I'm particularly interested in the positive psychology coaching that you're doing, that you're taking all of this study and learning and self-exploration and channeling it into a practice of coaching. And of course, one of the intriguing questions, I think, is what do you see as the difference between coaching and psychotherapy? Because you talk about people coming in and having a point of pain, and I think some people would say, well, isn't that doing therapy?
Right. And I think to me the difference, and it's a great question, and I don't think it will be completely answered here, and I think that the debate will be on for many years. In my mind, given my background, I see it as sort of a two-pronged approach where I need to teach people to manage their negative emotions, manage their negative thinking that they've grown up with, and then also to open them up or introduce them to new ways of thinking about the world. A lot of this is about mindset, and you can change your mindset through practice. And I just find that asking certain questions seems to elicit certain responses. What are you good at? What do you do well? What went well for you this week? What are your strengths? What are you passionate about? And then the other answer to the question is, I think the difference between psychotherapy and coaching is, in my practice at least, that part of the emphasis is spent with me teaching skills to my clients. So it's unlike traditional therapy in that in therapy, you're generally spending the whole session talking about yourself, focusing on what went wrong, focusing on the problem, trying to find ways around the problem. The emphasis is on the individual. The individual is doing most of the talking, or the client. In my practice, I can bring in, I have clients that come in that are young males, maybe 15 to 25 in some situations. They don't want to be there at all. They're mad about coming. And
How do they get there? Are they court referred?
A lot of times it's a parent that brings them in, or it could be court appointed. And they also don't have any hope. So a lot of people that I see have been, you know, I saw a guy last week that said, I've been to see 18 therapists. I was like, wow, you counted, huh? That's a lot. But I've seen a lot of people that have been to, you know, inpatient, outpatient, psychologists, counselors, therapists. You know, they've been to see everyone out there, and they come to see me, and I say, well, you know, I don't know if I can help you, but I have some tools that I can share with you that, if you choose to use them, have been helpful to me, have been helpful to hundreds of clients, and they may be helpful to you. So I think there's a different sort of framework in that, you know, I'm giving them the choice, them the power, and then saying, here's some tools I can teach you that actually have been shown to work in research. And there's a lot of younger people that are open to that approach. And then the other part is, I've got hours of PowerPoint presentations that I teach from. And so if I get a client coming in that is upset, or a lot of times it's male clients that just come in and they're not comfortable coming in and just spilling their guts. And so what I do is, I'll show them, you know, a short entertaining video clip that makes them laugh. I'll tell them a joke. I'll do a magic trick. And then I'll teach for a while. And there's no pressure on them to talk until they find themselves comfortable to do so. Mm-hmm. So I can just teach them for a long time, actually. And I've done this with high school students at a continuation high school, where, you know, the students are coming out of juvenile hall. So some of them have ankle monitors on. Some live in group homes. There's a variety of emotional and mental disorders going on, and it's a pretty tough crowd. And so I go in there once a month and I teach, and, you know, I tell them the same thing, and about 80-85% of them are open to listening. You know, I did a mindfulness exercise with them last year for the first time, and I was scared spitless. I didn't know how it was going to go. And about 90% of them actively tried to do it. And the principal said later, she emailed me and she said, wow, the campus has been so much calmer all afternoon.
That's wonderful. You know, some percentage of my listenership is composed of people who are counselors, therapists, as well as students who are hoping to become counselors, therapists, coaches. What would be your advice to somebody who wants to do something kind of like what you're doing? How would they break into that?
I would say if you want to do coaching specifically,
I would
say get a degree in some sort of counseling or therapy, like an MFT license, a master's or a PhD level degree first, because there's always going to be this ongoing debate between what's coaching and what's therapy. Mm-hmm. And to me, the two are essentially, you can't disentangle them, because as much as I try to keep the focus on teaching or psychoeducational or positive psych, human nature will bring the conversation back to what's going wrong with the client. So they have a very hard time not focusing on what's depressing them, what's making them angry, what's making them anxious. And I think that's fair. And so I think you need the ability to go both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And to address both the negative and the positive. And, you know, again, those are sort of misnomers, but you need the ability to deal with the dark and the light side.
That makes a lot of sense to me. What do you think about licensing? Because people who take the psychotherapy route have to be licensed. Currently, I don't believe there is any licensing for coaches. Do you mm-hmm. think it will go that way? Do you think it should or should not?
I would like to see greater oversight over the coaching industry. Some sort of licensing body would make sense to me, because as I said, it's too vaguely defined right now. You've got a lot of people in there that may or may not know what they're doing, that may or may not have enough education, and it gets complicated. I mean, you're getting into people's minds, whether you're dealing with goal setting or getting people to perform at their optimum. You're messing with people's minds, and the mind, as we know, is about as complex and involved as it can get.
Okay. That's fascinating. I suspect many coaches who I would put that question to would go the other way and say, no, we don't want all that uptight structure of licensing and so on.
Well, yeah, I understand that point of view. I just think that it's very difficult. I mean, for instance, what if you're a coach and you have a client come in that has a personality disorder and you don't know enough to spot it?
Yeah, I think that would be a concern that many professional psychologists would have about the whole coaching movement. Well, that's a whole big discussion, and I'm glad to have at least been able to touch on that with you. I'm wondering, as we sort of start to wind down here, if there are any areas that maybe you haven't gotten a chance to talk about that you were hoping that you would.
Oh, boy. Well, I have a joke I can share with you. I'm a big fan of humor, and the idea that, you know, making people laugh and making people smile is a great way to open them up to new information and also to undo those negative effects of destructive emotions.
Yes.
Okay, so you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. Okay, so there's a psychologist running a group therapy session. And in this group therapy session, there are four mothers, and each mother has a small child with her. And the psychologist looks at the mothers and he says, "You are all obsessed. And it shows up in your children's names." And he points to the first mother and he says, "You are obsessed with eating. You went so far as to name your daughter Candy." And he looks at the second mother and he says, "And you are obsessed with money and with shopping. Your daughter's name is Penny." And to the third mother, he says, "And you have a problem with alcohol. Your daughter's name is Brandy." And at that, the fourth mother stands up, grabs her son by the arm, and says, "Come on, Dick, we're getting out of here." Now, the funny part to me of that story is that I told that on the radio when I was doing the radio show, and the station owner, I got great feedback from it initially. When it was rerun, the station owner called me in and said, "John, we can't run the show anymore. We're getting complaints." And I said, "Well, what are people complaining about?" And he said, "Well, it's a reference to sex in the joke." And I said, "Well, what's dirty about it?" And he couldn't come up with an answer. I said, "Look, you know, you've got to realize that whatever is dirty in that joke is a product of what's going on in the listener's mind. Because I don't say whether or not that sex is taking place within a marriage or outside of a marriage. So unless someone has a problem with sex in general and finds it disgusting and aversive, there's nothing dirty in that joke." And of course, still wasn't rerun, but I think you got the point. And to me, it's a good story to illustrate just how different mindsets can interpret the same thing.
Yes, yes. Well, this has been fascinating speaking with you, John, and I hope to talk to you more down the line. So Dr. John Shinnerer, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Absolutely, David. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
I certainly hope you enjoyed this interview with Dr. John Shinnerer and found it as instructive as I did. As you've probably figured out by now, positive psychology is one of my current interests. You heard me make reference to some past interviews on the topic, and I'm sure this won't be the last. And if you search at shrinkwrapradio.com on positive psychology, you'll probably find a number of interviews. As you heard me mention, I have an upcoming presentation on positive psychology that I'll be giving in the Lifelong Learning Program at Sonoma State University this coming January. And as you might imagine, I'm in the process of gathering material for those lectures. I've got a nice stack of books that I'll be culling highlights from. Certainly one of the books I'll be consulting is Dr. Shinnerer's Guide to Self. It's clear that he put a lot of time and study into the writing of it. It's a beautiful integration of the academic material along with practical suggestions about how to apply the insights of positive psychology into your own life. Dr. Shinnerer's assertion that there are, at this point, some 50,000 studies on positive psychology particularly snagged my attention. I know there has been considerable research interest, but I had no idea that the number of studies was anywhere near that magnitude. I intend to follow up and see if I can track down a reference for that statistic. At any rate, I recommend Dr. Shinnerer's book to you without hesitation. As I mentioned in the introduction, the book is available at Amazon.com and other online booksellers. You might like to visit Dr. Shinnerer's website, which you'll find at www.guidetoself.com. And you can send email directly to John at guidetoself.com.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello again, all you wonderful listeners out there. Well, I had my interview with Dr. Richard Davidson, who has been studying the brainwaves of meditators, both novice and long-term, earlier this week. It probably won't be up here, however, for another month or so. Thanks to those of you who sent in questions. One thing I didn't realize when I set out to get him is that he was named one of the top 100 most influential people by Time magazine in 2006. So I'm really glad to have been able to speak to him. Another big fish for Dr. Dave. By the way, there's a three-part PBS series running in the U.S. right now called This Emotional Life. Both he and the Dalai Lama are featured in this third episode, along with Fred Luskin, who I interviewed on forgiveness previously. Speaking of interviews, be sure to catch my latest interview at wisecounselpodcast.com. It's with UCLA psychologist Dr. Charlotte Resnick, and it's all about helping children cope with anxiety and stress via imagery. She's very creative in her uses of imagery, so I'm sure you'll find it to be of interest. In my post-interview commentary with Dr. Shinnerer, I mentioned that I was going to be giving two lectures on positive psychology and happiness in the Lifelong Learning Program here at Sonoma State University. Well, some time has passed since I recorded those remarks, and I actually did the first of those presentations earlier this week, and will give the second one next week. I was very pleased with the reception of my initial presentation. There were about 150 seniors in the audience. I recorded the presentation on my iPhone, and I'll probably make the audio file and my PowerPoint slides available in the Shrink Wrap Radio store in the near future. I hope that'll be of interest to you. I'm working on lining up a good guest to comment on Jung's Red Book. I've already been turned down, unfortunately, for one reason or another, by several potential guests who are close to that project. I'm sure to get someone good, though. If you're a fan of C.G. Jung, you'll probably have heard of the Red Book. I invite you to submit some potential questions for my guest when that interview finally does happen. As I mentioned last time, if you heard an ad at the beginning of this podcast, what they call a pre-roll, then it means you're getting this podcast through Mevio. And I'm in the process of disengaging from Mevio, so let me urge any Mevio listeners to go directly to shrinkwrapradio.com to get this show, or to click on our iTunes link there to subscribe to it directly in iTunes. If you are a listener and not a subscriber, please do become a subscriber. It costs nothing, just means you get a more automatic delivery of the show, and it helps me to have some idea of the size of my audience. The easiest way to subscribe is through iTunes. There are other podcatcher software and sites out there, but there is a subscription link to iTunes in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. For some reason, our number of subscribers seems to have taken a bit of a dip. I don't know if it's the changeover in the year, the decade, or what, But please help us to grow our audience by telling your friends, colleagues, family, so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. And I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, your Facebook, or Twitter. And I'm gathering more friends on Twitter, and you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. And once again, thanks to all of you who've made financial donations. As we go into this new year, please consider making a continuing 6-month or 12-month donation using the big green donate button on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Your donations provide an important, predictable base, which is greatly appreciated, and they allow me to deliver a commercial-free show. And thanks to those of you who've renewed your ongoing subscription as well. By the way, there are transcripts available for most of our episodes. I know there are many other podcasts and other sources of information that compete for your time. So if you don't have time to listen to some of the back Shrink Wrap Radio episodes that you may have missed, you can scan through a transcript much more quickly than listening to the interview. Of course, you'll miss my dulcet tones, but you'll at least get the info.
Hi, this is Jungian author and psychotherapist Dr. Jerry Rule, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you for that transition, Dr. Jerry Rule. In fact, he'll be my guest on the next show, and I'll tell you a bit more later on. So let's dip into the email bag. First, we hear from Eric Begay, who has an ad on the top 10 widget on our site. And he writes, Dr. Dave, thanks for your email and your hard work, especially in these economic times. Often I find tender morsels of inspirations from your guests. Anyhow, you can add silversmithing / jewelry making to that list of what people do when they listen to your podcast. Keep up the great work and happy holidays. Take care, Eric. Thank you. And that's from Eric Begay. And you might check out his ad on our site and get yourself some jewelry. Next, we hear from licensed professional counselor Joe, who writes, Dr. Dave, I just signed up for $5 per month for 12 months. Really love the show. You are doing a better than fantastic job. Well, Joe, thank you both for the donation and for the praise. And going on, Joe says, I never get tired of the mindfulness and meditation shows you do. I've had a meditation practice for about a year and a half now. I don't think you've ever stated whether you have a meditation practice on the show. If so, what type of meditation do you do? Holosync? Just curious. Have you heard of the meditation practice called centering prayer? It's mentioned in one sentence in Dan Siegel's book, The Mindful Brain, so I assume there might be some research on it, but I'm sure there's not much. Anyhow, I'm very thankful for the show. Please keep up the great work. And that's from licensed professional counselor Joe. And Joe, I am a irregular meditator, I have to confess. I'm sort of have not established a totally disciplined approach, but I try to bring mindfulness to my daily life. And so I guess what I practice both informally and sometimes formally is mindfulness meditation, particularly following my breath seems to be the tool that works for me. And often, actually, I do it at night when I'm in bed. That's a pretty regular discipline, but not as often as a sitting formal meditation. So there's my big confession. Moving along, Elizabeth in Ypsilanti, Michigan writes, Dear Dr. Van Nuys, I've been enjoying your podcast greatly. Appreciate your kindness and curiosity, which come across every time. I also like hearing that you got your training near where I am at the University of Michigan. The university continues to be a fine place, even as the state suffers hard knocks at this time. I hope we will emerge from this rough tumble and be well again. I was prompted to write after listening to your interview with Sarah Lazar. The substance of her discussion was so fascinating, also encouraging. What struck me as a person who tends to talk quickly and sometimes plentifully, like Professor Lazar, was that there is a person who meditates and daily touches the depth and calm, yet listening had me feeling anxious, though happy with the content. Her speech seemed quite nervous and bumpy, and I was puzzled. Perhaps it was anxiety in being interviewed on the radio, but it was a curious thing. That inner calm might not translate into outward calm, even after many years of practice. In a way, it was a comfort, strangely, as I sense a similar disjunction in myself. As I revel in greater calm and expansiveness and feel it making my life feel better, my encounters with others don't necessarily match those sensations and states. But I am confused. I would think the greater calm from meditation would translate into greater calm in how I interact with others. But there was a practitioner with great knowledge whose delivery to me conveyed great nervousness. How to square these two things? I'd be thrilled to hear your thoughts, though I know you are an exquisitely busy man and might not have the time to send any feedback. I'll take this opportunity to send my appreciation and respect for what you do and your seemingly ceaseless energy and curiosity. May I share those qualities in time. Warm thanks and good greetings, Elizabeth. And I wrote back to Elizabeth. Here's what I said. Thanks for your kind words about Shrink Wrap Radio. I never seem to tire of the positive feedback. I used to lead student groups at Ypsilanti State Hospital, so I certainly recognize that name. I doubt that Sarah Lazar was particularly nervous about being interviewed. Her research has drawn a lot of notice, and I think she's been interviewed a whole bunch. In fact, in our email exchanges, her communications were strikingly casual and offhand. For example, she'd respond to my email queries with a yup, and that would be it. My guess is that her fast talking, and perhaps yours, has been with her all her life and may even have a genetic component. It may be unrealistic to expect that years of meditation will change such basic characteristics. Maybe if she had been living in a monastery all this time. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. Please leave me some voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, or a voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. John Shinnerer, for sharing his insights on the use of positive psychology in coaching. On our next show, I'll be speaking with Jerry Rule, Ph.D., who is a Jungian therapist and the executive director of the Houston Jung Center. With Robert Johnson, Jerry is the co-author of three books on psychology and spirituality, including Living Your Unlived Life. So you won't want to miss that one. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Thank you.